Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Populism should be about seeking solutions that help the most people. It shouldn't be about letting your ideology get dragged around by the horse of, if my enemies feel pain, that's good enough, right? Like, one hedge fund getting screwed is not like the triumph of populism.
Derek Thompson of The Atlantic is one of Sagar and my favorite writers. We usually have shows that are very narratively focused. It's this big idea. Let's talk about it. But Derek's writing on everything from the future of media to the future of cities, Democratic Party, the Republican Party, political realignments. Everything he's writing is just so close to the themes we focused on in the show, especially after the 2020 election, that we just wanted to have a wide-ranging episode where we covered pretty much everything he's written about.
I love talking to Derek. We hit Wall Street bets, GameStop, whether it's a populist thing or not, what real populism is, the rise of cities in the Southwest because of people working remote, how that's going to change American politics, how that's going to screw likely the future of the GOP, the future of the Democratic Party. You guys get the idea. Literally everything that we talk about here every single day. Oh, and we hit tech too. So basically every single theme of this podcast was covered in a single episode, which is something that we're particularly proud of on this one. So make sure that you check out his work at The Atlantic.
And before we get into the episode, you guys all know the deal. Subscribe to our Substack. Go check out Derek's book, Hitmakers, How to Succeed in an Age of Distraction, at our bookshop link. We get a commission and you support a local bookseller. And most importantly, rate and review the podcast.
All right, let's get to the question and answer period. All right, we're going to try something out new here a little bit. We've gotten enough 5-star reviews, so thank you all very much. Go ahead and submit all your questions to therealignment.substack.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter and you can reply to those emails. We get those emails, or you can leave a comment on any of those posts. That's where we're going to be taking questions from now on. So, Marshall, what is our question this week?
This is from, and this wins the award for our most unique username yet, Teddy Roosevelt's burner account. Great podcast hosted by the two most forward. Quick editorial note. What I love about the realignment theme of that question name is I'm not quite sure if this person is far right or progressive.
Yeah, or far left. Yes.
It could literally be either direction. So definitely send us an email at our Substack. I'm curious to know what the answer is. But here's the question. Great podcast hosted by two of the most forward thinking folks in all of politics. Question. Relating to the game stonk situation. I can't help but pick up on something Marshall said on the emergency pod, which is that there is a not very insignificant amount of very wealthy people who are fully backing this movement. It seems to me that the reason for this is in large fact that a full democratization of the stock market would mean more money for them. Given that a big reason why GameStop in particular blew up in the way it did was because of the overlap between Redditors and gamers, it doesn't seem like much of a coincidence that many of the rich people cheering it on, Elon Musk, Dave Portnoy, are the social media savvy type who, in my mind, seem to be attempting to parlay their good graces on the internet into cashing in on a sort of public approval stroke that would come from the democratization of all of this. Am I reading too much into this? And doesn't this seem like this is just as bad of a system as the status quo? How can we push for a better regulation that doesn't enable market manipulation for Redditors or hedge funds without seeming like hypocrites for pushing for it now? Sorry for the long question. Love the podcast. Teddy Roosevelt's burner account. Please actually read the name on air. That would be so dope. Well, we got that done for you. So now, Sagar, what is your take?
Well, actually, luckily, we cover literally all of this in the episode, so I'll keep it really short, which is that your suspicions are correct. I've actually been thinking and listening and trying to figure out what some of the best regulation is that you can do around this stuff. A lot of it basically comes down to this. We need higher capital gains taxes, which will get Grover Norquist to shoot me in the face. Marshall, what do you think?
Well, now that Sagar has left the podcast, we'll have to do a bigger rethinking of what we're doing here. But no, the actual thing here is you should just recognize what people are selling. Something that we're really frustrated in the media space is there's a lot of people, especially on Twitter, who are giving their takes in ways that either improve their brand or build up their actual portfolio. So what I would suggest is actually look and read media sources. That became such a generic, trite thing to say during the Trump era, but it's actually true. Avoid getting your news on this topic from Twitter. I'm pretty sure anyone who did that came away more uninformed than they were before.
All right. And as always, thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate all the work that they let us do here. And now let's get to the show.
Derek Thompson, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to see you, Derek.
Good to see you.
We were talking about this before the show, but typically we'll have a narrative. But when we were researching for this, Derek, you wrote a piece on Wall Street Bets. And then I woke up this morning and there was a great thing on Zoom. You go a bit back earlier, there's a conversation about how millennials moving will transform American politics. The show is called The Realignment. So we're giving up with a tidy narrative and we're just going to have a wide ranging conversation, basically about everything you've written since I'd say mid 2019. Most of that is going to hold up despite the coronavirus stuff. So let's start here. We did an emergency episode about the Wall Street Bets fiasco. And basically over the weekend, all of that's completely invalidated. You had a piece on Friday that was talking about Anthony Scaramucci's point that this could be the next French Revolution. Anyone who followed this news this weekend shows that that narrative is a bit mixed. So just, can you just give us a narrative state of play? Where are we at with Wall Street Bets?
Wow, you guys are starting off with the hardest possible question. Explain Wall Street Bets in 15 seconds. Here's I think, a good way to think about the last week. Think about it from the lens of everything you thought was true about this story is wrong. Like, the original take on the story was that this was like a really, really clean David versus Goliath narrative, except in this version of the David versus Goliath narrative, because, you know, people thought that Robinhood paused trading on GameStop in order to help the hedge funds, you know, the Goliath in this case. It's a little bit like, I suppose, in the original David Goliath story, if like the slingshot that David was using malfunctioned based on a magical spell that the Goliath cast on the slingshot. But it turned out, I could continue to unspool that metaphor, but there's no point in doing so because it's just clearly not true. The tidy David versus Goliath narrative was just wrong. First, Reddit's, you know, Wall Street Bets subreddit just isn't really a David. It really seems like some of the oldest and longest tenured subscribers of this subreddit, like, work in wealth management. Like, they work in the finance industry. This is just like their virtual bar where they come together and get a little drunk and talk about their favorite trades. Like, they're not really the ordinary common man. They're probably more like people that are making a six-figure salary and just love betting. So David isn't quite David. No question that Goliath is Goliath. Like, the hedge fund is a hedge fund, and that's clear. But the Robin Hood story in particular was just totally misunderstood. I mean, what clearly seems to have happened.
Let's explain that, Derek, because I think the key point was, and this is where I actually blame Robin Hood a lot just for like not explaining this clearly. I mean, look, I'm not going to say the guy lied, but Andrew Ross Sorkin asked the CEO on live television, he's like, do you have a capital problem, liquidity problem? And he said, I think he said no. And then in the last 24 to 48 hours, he's raised, what, $2.4
billion? Almost $3 billion.
Almost $3 billion. So I'm like, okay, sounds like he had a liquidity problem. Then he puts out a statement later, I think it was yesterday or the day before, when he's like, yeah, we had to halt trading because our clearinghouse, which executes our trades, was like, hey, you need more money in the bank in order to comply. Was it some Dodd-Frank regulation? Anyway, as you said, the clear answer on the story, if they had just said why they were pausing trading and not had been a lot more forthcoming about it, then I think a lot of the conspiracy theorizing would be a lot less than where we are right now, right?
You're totally right. You're saying that, I think, very, very well. I mean, you had the night that Robinhood paused trading on GameStop and a couple of the other memes, GameStop and a couple of the other meme stocks. Always very difficult to have the word GameStop and stock in the same sentence.
Yes, yes.
But that same night, it was Dave Portnoy, the CEO of Barstool, going on Tucker Carlson and saying that these guys should be put in prison because this is the greatest scandal in the history of American finance or something. Sorry, back up two steps. The actual story is that a startup brokerage didn't have enough money to deal with an unprecedented day of volatility on a meme stock popularized by people who were classic game, classic Robinhood users.
Yes.
So, right. In a way, to return to my extremely tortured David versus Goliath metaphor, the slingshot did break. The slingshot broke, but it broke because it was like a startup slingshot.
Yes.
It broke because it wasn't like they didn't want to use old brokerages. They were using some, you know, new non zero commission trade brokerage. And that's why it broke. So look, I just don't have a great deal of sympathy for the notion that what we saw was just an extraordinary display of good old fashioned American populism. Mm-hmm. Good old fashioned American populism. No, sorry, scrap that. Good new fashioned American populism. Just good populism should be public policies that try to get money into the hands of middle class and lower middle class people so that they can save money, which is put in an index fund that they never fucking think about. That's populism. Instead, what we're talking about is asking upper middle class and maybe middle class people who do have some money to spend to become day traders. Like, that is the meme that was getting out there from AOC and a bunch of other people who should just know better. Like, if these people want to play around with Robinhood, they want to play around with day trading, like, whatever. I'm not that much of a paternalist, but it should not be the point of order for, like, leading American left populists like AOC to valorize day trading. She should be telling people, she should be A, working on policies that make the middle class richer, and B, trying to get middle class people to save money by putting in index funds that are broadly diversified that they never have to think about. The best way to play the market is not to play at all. And that basic message about investing and wealth creation and wealth building got totally lost as everyone was just trying to shimmy this like grizzly bear of a story into the little perfectly thin corset of a David versus Goliath narrative. And it just didn't work.
I'm so glad that you said that, Derek, because I am watching people like meme themselves into becoming free market libertarians. And I'm like, no, stop. Speculation is not like a good thing. We should not be encouraging people to like wildly speculate on it. And then the counter to that that I'm hearing is like, well, you know, they do it all the time. I'm like, yeah, I agree. Let's stop it. Like, it's bad. You know, there's a lot of things which are happening, you know, on the street which are bad. And let's get back to what you talked about there with populism, what new age and good populism would look like. Because here's the fascinating part, which is that, as you said, people should know better because the impetus is real. As in, there are a lot of people who are like, hey, you know what? Screw Wall Street. And if you look at, you know, some of the people who I think are downstream of the money managers and others who are on Wall Street bets, look at the emotion that you actually can see in some of these posts. They're like, look, my dad lost his job in 2008. Like, I sat there and we all ate ramen. Some of my friends ate tomato soup that was made out of cafeteria ketchup packets. And then what they're doing is that they are channeling that energy into obviously buying GameStop stock. Now look, maybe it worked out this time, but I think most people who are getting in on the trade are probably gonna get hosed. But the key point there is that there is an underlying like impetus and desire to say, screw you, to a lot of people on Wall Street. And I actually think that's a good thing. I think that's important. Now, get to that in particular though, which is that how you channel that how do you channel that correct message that you just pointed out in an environment where you have a lot of people who are willing to just meme themselves or use the meme of GameStop itself in order to push like their own radical agenda one way or the other?
Yeah, I think that the people who are trying to essentially hitch a ride on the glider of this story are just totally misunderstanding what populism should be about in the first place.
Yes.
Populism should be about seeking solutions that help the most people. It shouldn't be about letting your ideology get dragged around by the horse of, if my enemies feel pain, that's good enough, right?
Yes. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
One hedge fund getting screwed is not like the triumph of populism. Mm.
Especially when other hedge funds are on the other side of the bet.
19 other hedge funds that are up 800%.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know who the biggest shareholders of GameStop were on January 15th?
Yeah, it's like BlackRock or or something. Yeah,
Fidelity and BlackRock, a bunch of other hedge funds. Like, it's just crazy. Hey,
they're youngest by like 20. I'm kidding.
Yeah. A bunch of billionaires became more billionaire-ish as a result of this trade. And yes, some middle-class people also made a couple thousand dollars, and that's cool. But like, the triumph of populism is not, let's find one bad guy and force him to experience such excruciating pain that we can like distribute the pain psychologically over the mass of the American population and like that's their victory. No, like what policy would work here? It should be to like, we should be talking about like getting people money, you know, expanding child allowances, just, you know, boring meat and potato stuff, expanding their earned income tax credit if we like that. I love the Biden buck stimulus plan. Let's talk about telling people that if they are really interested in wealth formation, especially in their 20s and 30s, that the formula for wealth formation is really simple. You spend less than you earn if you are in a tax bracket or in at an income level that allows you to do so. And then what you don't spend, you basically put into a Fidelity diversified index and don't think about it for 40 years. Like, that's what we should be talking about. We shouldn't be having AOC getting on Twitch, talking to the stock guy, whoever the fuck, and like valorizing day trading and speculation as if like they are the Williams Jennings Bryans of the future. Like, they're not. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just a stupid way to talk about getting rich in the long term.
So something I want to understand better is, A, the meaning of the term establishment, especially in this context, because something that was very frustrating for me from a media perspective is you had a bunch of people, Dave Portnoy, Anthony Pompliano, who's a big crypto decentralization guy, the Winklevi twins making their like constant, like their ability to just appear in cultural moments is just incredible. Like, that's their actual superpower. But in many ways, these are people who are not the traditional establishment, but in many ways are their own sort of like decentralized establishment. Chamath himself, Polyapatia, has his own like very political agenda and is a very good person at using populist ideas and rhetoric. So how do we just sort through who's using what to do? Well, I guess I'm just trying to look for a good mental framework, because what was so frustrating is you would just see all these people say, sorry, a better way to put this, there was this instance where the Winklevi twins were asked, hey, do you guys have any money in this? They said, oh, no, we don't, but we're just encouraging people to do it. I'm like, oh, well, you're encouraging people to do this because you're advancing, you want these people all to buy Bitcoin. So there's all this dynamic where everything's all tied together. So how do we think about that? Because that's what I think people are lacking the most.
That's a great, great question. So maybe ironically, like, I'm talking about what I consider to be good populism. I think that that I don't actually consider myself, according to most people's definition, like a populist. I'm more of like a utilitarian and like a consequentialist, which are just like stupid multisyllabic ways of saying, I want to do good for the most people. And I don't care about the moral intentions of any policy unless it actually does good. So that's where I stand on public policy in general. So on Chamath, for instance, seems like a really bright guy. I don't know a lot about him. I would like to know more. But I saw a lot of people in my Twitter feed tweeting a really interesting juxtaposition of two different tweets. One of them was his saying that he only cares about two things, climate change and income inequality. And the other was him, I believe, talking about how it's really terrible to talk about raising taxes on capital gains. Well, look, one of the reasons why we have income inequality is that you've got lots of people that are building massive wealth based on their investments, which are preferenced by the tax code because of lower capital gains taxes. So, you know, it actually would make sense in the biggest picture to try to reduce income inequality by raising taxes on capital gains for the purpose of redistributing that income to the low, to the poor. That's not the only way to do it. And I'm not sure that, you know, raising capital gains taxes is at the top of my list. But that is like an interesting tension, I think, between his two positions. And I would just like us to talk more clearly about like what are the ways to help people that we think are like good policy for the vast majority of people. Like, what's a good utilitarian way to think through this problem? And it's just very clear to me at like a sort of just first level analysis that advocating for speculation, glorifying speculators just because they happen to have identified like a big bad wolf in the forest in the form of this hedge fund, that's not going to cash out as a benefit for most people. That is a bad utilitarian policy.
What's so great about this is you're getting to a frustration I had as someone who, I'm not finance first, like this is not my space, but a lot of people, especially when the news was that Robinhood was intervening in a really negative way. We're saying, see, this is why we need crypto. This is why we need the blockchain. This is why decentralization is the answer. No one was actually articulating, though, like why those things were inherently good. So rather than saying it's really bad that we're not letting normal people operate in a casino economy, we therefore need to use decentralization to further that. They just said decentralization is good in of itself. So I just think that people should really take away the case for, in these spaces where we don't have that much information, using the utilitarian framework.
Yeah. And when it comes to Bitcoin and crypto, I should say, I am not an expert on this space. I feel strongly about only two things when it comes to Bitcoin. First, I remember the debate from 5 years ago or so when people said, you know, Bitcoin could be the future of currency. Well, it's a terrible currency. No one ever does or ever should use Bitcoin to buy, you know, bananas and toilet paper because it's an extremely volatile asset. But it is an interesting asset. And it is being used by a lot of people in lieu of something like gold or silver as a kind of hedge. And I'm curious to see the evolution of cryptocurrencies as a sort of asset used within a well-diversified portfolio to hedge against various macroeconomic outcomes or sort of trading volatility. So that's what I would say with crypto. But I am not sure exactly about how it's going to evolve as an actual currency the next few years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. Also, it takes forever. If you ever send any Bitcoin to somebody else, it takes like an hour in order to prove on the blockchain. I think this is another question that we have, Derek, which is that if we're looking forward, kind of the theme here is about there's a shifting moment right now in American politics. You actually just wrote a piece today, which caused like a little bit of a stir, about remote work. And I thought it was really interesting just about how remote work and is going to change the nature of cities, the geographic makeup of America. It's basically, I think the what was the term? It was the what the highway was to the 1950s, 1960s of America. So let's talk about that. Both, let's start with like a civilian level. Like, what is that going to mean just for our day-to-day lives and the makeup of our cities in the future?
Yeah. So let's start at like the 30,000 foot level. Remote work. It's not something everyone can do, right? It's something the three of us can do, or I guess technically four of us on the Zoom call now. None of us are in the same room, I think, unless there's some trickery going on. And yet we're all having a conversation that's really easy. That's fantastic. And this is a fact of life for today's knowledge workers or white collar workers. It's not true for a retail salesperson. It's not true for a cashier. It's not true for a nurse or a surgeon. There are tens of millions of jobs that at the moment just cannot be telecommutable. And that's just a fact. But there's lots that can. And what this article is saying is that even a moderate revolution in remote work could have huge implications for the geography of opportunity in America. And the reason for that, I suppose, could be most efficiently put like this. We have a problem in the 21st century economy where the American dream has been bifurcated. It's been split. The cities that are the best at upward mobility, right, at taking someone who is born lower middle class, but they can become upper middle class. The cities that are best at that kind of economic mobility are prohibitively expensive. They're places like New York, San Francisco, Seattle. And the places that are cheap are not particularly good at upward mobility. And so the American dream that wherever you are, you can plug yourself into an economy wherein if you work hard, you can, you know, move ahead in class. We can criticize that dream, and that's probably another podcast or two. I have lots of issues with it. But in reality, the fact of that thing has split apart. And the reason it's split apart is because basically America's most productive cities are just too expensive. There's a shortage of housing. Now, historically, the fact of a city has always meant the tethering of home and work, right? You farmed in the city that you worked. You went to the mill or the factory in the 19th century in the city where you worked. What would it mean if work and home were untethered in some way? Would Americans all move to the suburbs as they did in the 1950s? Would they move to the exurbs and become super commuters, as it's sometimes called? Or will they essentially keep their job in Boston but move to Phoenix? Keep their job in Washington, D.C., where I live, but move to, you know, Minneapolis? I think it's very possible that you could see a large share of the white-collar workforce decide that if they can keep their job wherever they live, they'd much rather buy a bigger house just somewhere else. And enough of them are going to do that that it could have major implications for the shape of the American economy and the distribution of America's most talented productive workers.
Mm-hmm. What's great about the piece is, and it helps to write this piece 6 months into the pandemic rather than right during, is we saw lots of overstated cases. New York City is just totally over. That was back in August. Mm-hmm. The whole case of everyone's going to move to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Mm-hmm. Your point is that your piece isn't anti-city. It's anti-cities that have specific negative traits, because too many of the decentralization, like my whole theme today is basically pushing back against decentralization, folks, is people's objection isn't to the city. It's to the objection of the cost being too high. It's the objection having to, if you're living in New York, you have to like pay lots of money to go to a really expensive private school versus going to, for example, I'm from Portland, Oregon. You mm-hmm. could live in the outer suburbs and go to an excellent, excellent like public high school. So it's not anti-city in of itself. Something we're wondering, though, is to what degree is the sort of case for a city like New York in this? Because from my perspective, I want to move to New York. I want to go into the middle of everything. Charlotte's great. You know, Austin's great, but they don't have the center. Like, there is a case you made to the city. Can you speak to, like, what the sort of more bull case for a city like New York, San Francisco, L.A., these places that have a lot of mistakes, but, like, 1970s New York, 1980s New York, that was way worse than it. Well, maybe not, but hypothetically, that was a situation that could be just as bad, if not worse.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's almost a cliche to say this pandemic will accelerate X.
Yes.
But in this case, the cliche is a cliche for a reason, as so many cliches are. So 2 years ago, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic, an essay called The Future of the Childless City. And like all headlines, this was an exaggeration and simplification of what I was really saying, which is that in a lot of rich, expensive, highly productive cities like your New Yorks and San Francisco's, Seattle's, families with kids seem to be moving out, and young college-educated people who were single seem to be moving in. And so the culture of the city was evolving towards servicing the interests of the young and affluent. They were becoming playgrounds for young, colleged 20-somethings and 30-somethings. I think what I'm predicting about New York is that that will accelerate, because more families with established jobs at knowledge worker companies, I don't want to be too, you know, economic and fancy here, knowledge worker companies, I mean, like, you know, Google, a PR firm, a marketing firm, design firm, you're established at the company, you have a good relationship with the boss, you have two kids under the age of six, and you live in a part of Brooklyn or Manhattan or the Bronx that is just using New York as an example here, it's just a little too crammed, right? It's a little crammed, and more importantly, it's really expensive.
You know what you're saying? You're saying you're Andrew Yang, speaking of his...
And so you think, like, you know, whenever I visit my friends in the suburbs, they have these lawns. Sometimes they have pools.
Yeah, it's
and
nice.
And so you move. And so I'm not suggesting anything too radical here, except that more parents in that position will make the decision to leave those cities, and their decision will enjoy the tailwind of the remote work revolution, because people will recognize, I can move to these cities, you know, an hour away, an hour and a half away, cities and suburbs and small towns outside of New York, come into the office once a week, once every 2 weeks, and that will be fine. Mm-hmm. I can have a much bigger house and everything will be fine professionally. I think that is the trend that is more likely to accelerate. And the way I describe it in the piece is to say that it's the rise of the super commuter. So historically, super commuting is something that has really been more like an affliction on poor, low-income workers in places like San Francisco and New York, where you couldn't afford to live in the East Village, so you lived out in Brooklyn. You had to commute 50 minutes, 120 minutes a day into your job. But what if the next stage in the growth of super commuters, people commuting more than like an hour a day, are these affluent families who move up in the Hudson Valley and move out into Central California, if we're talking about San Francisco, because they recognize they don't have to come and to the office as much. That's what I'm predicting. And one more point that I just want to make, because I think when I talk about remote work, a lot of people say this. They say, I wouldn't do that. Okay, mm-hmm. fine. That's great. There are tens of millions of people that I'm talking about in these categories. And if just a small number of them behave differently, it could have a huge effect. And the right metaphor here is to think about the retail sector. So in 2015, online retail accounted for less than 10% of all retail. Less than 10%, right? Amazon, Walmart.com, everything. But still, if you had any conversation about the future of retail, it was about e-commerce. So the 9% tail was wagging the dog of the other 91%. You could have a similar thing happen with remote work, where even if just 9% of the US workforce is fully remote in, say, 2024, someone could say, oh, look, you know, Derek was predicting a remote work revolution, and 91% of Americans are still working in offices and, you know, stores and hospitals. Well, that's fine. But the 9% could still have a huge effect on which cities are growing, which cities are shrinking, where are productive, talented people moving. The 9% can still be huge.
So you kind of hit at this when you made the point that the problem is basically that the big super zip cities are too expensive, but the red operationally sunbelt southern cities aren't as great about actually providing opportunity to the same degree. How much of this is a partisan phenomenon? Because basically the way this is described, just depending on which part of Twitter you hang out at, is the red state people say, see, Texas is cheap, Florida is cheap, all the libs are fleeing expensive New York and SF. And then they then at the same time will say things like, and what is going to happen negatively is they're going to move to a city like Austin and then import a lot of the, like, for example, a lot of the Texas is a state that's very sort of pro-development. So a lot of Austin tech bros, I mean, sort of SF tech bros are going to move to Austin and they're going to bring NIMBYism with them. How much is that like a reality, or is this really a phenomenon which isn't that partisan in terms of like decisions cities are making from a Republican or Democratic perspective?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think it's hard to disentangle in a coherent way the motivations of millions of people at once. So if you imagine all these people who want to move and are moving to the Atlanta Metro, the Austin Metro, the Phoenix Metro, the Las Vegas Metro, Charlotte is booming, Columbus, Ohio is booming. Most of these places are in the South and West, but they're somewhat sprinkled across the country. Hard to disentangle why all of these people are moving at once. Some of them might be doing so politically. They're like, they're fed up with California. Mm-hmm. A lot of, and they're conservative. But I think a lot of them are moving because they are in their late 20s to early 40s. Their family is just getting started. And family life with kids is just a fundamentally different thing than being single in a city running around with your friends. And as a result, you have a lot of just family-based decisions, which by virtue of the fact that they are family-based, are about where can I be happy and feel comfortable with my wife or my husband? Where's a pretty good public school district for my kids? And where can I buy a house that's gonna make us all feel comfortable and happy at a price level that makes sense for my current job? And I think that those sort of social, cultural, familial, economic factors are probably driving moves more than the political consideration.
It's funny though, Derek, because thinking about that, that actually has huge political ramifications, because I was pulling up your article right here. According to the chief economist of Zillow, the online searches for Boise, Phoenix, and Atlanta are rising fastest amongst people who live in LA and New York. I'm like, oh, well, Phoenix and Atlanta, that's interesting. Those are two states which just went blue for the first time in a long time. And if I'm a party with Marjorie Taylor Greene as my mascot, I'm like, oh shit, I don't know if I'm ever going to win the state of Arizona or Georgia again. So it's funny because this isn't a political story. It's like you said, outside of like Joe Rogan, most people cannot afford to leave California because they're like, oh, these lockdowns are crazy. Like, that's like Elon Musk and Joe. That's not actually representative of a lot of people. But a lot of people like me and you, and I totally empathize, especially on a day like today in Washington where I got hit with some ice this morning on my face. I was like, yeah, you know, Phoenix sounds pretty nice right now. And it's like, yeah, more space, dog can take a walk and not have to get hit with ice. Maybe have two dogs, three dogs. I'm kind of a dog guy. And so I'm like, oh, this is actually pretty good. You start a family, your kids, you don't have to walk in the ice, blah, blah, blah. So that, though, it becomes metapolitical in the sense that we're changing the electorate. And we generally know, and this is something you wrote a lot about during the primary, I cited it actually a lot of my show Rising, was that what's the Democratic Party right now, Derek? A lot of it is linked to, especially the people that we're talking about here, are probably most likely to become the super mobile workforce of the next 5 years. So how do you think that that's going to play out? Whereas, you know, if enough people move to Phoenix and Atlanta, which has already happened, or even Austin, I mean, I believe the most common U-Haul route in the country pre-pandemic was San Francisco to Austin. This is going to dramatically change, you know, the electorate. And on the margins, that's red or it's blue. That's, you know, 100 electoral votes that we're talking about.
Look, I think you're entirely right. The piece that I think you might be referencing by me is a piece where I said that for Democrats, density is destiny.
Yes.
Diplomas and density really together are destiny, to be maximally alliterative. It is Democrats are dominating now among people with college degrees, and they're dominating in large metros. I had a draft of a piece that ended up being sort of disentangled and thrown into 17 different other pieces. But I just pulled it up as you were talking, and I'm just going to read two paragraphs from it.
Do
because
it.
Like what I wrote here is as articulate as I'll be on the point that you're making. So I'm writing about how the pandemic is accelerating this migration toward the South and West. This is now quoting from the article that never appeared. Quote, between 2010 and 2018, the eight metros that added the most domestic movers were, in order, Dallas, Phoenix, Houston, Austin, Tampa, Atlanta, Charlotte, and San Antonio. If you take a good hard look at that list, you'll see something that connects those cities beyond their infernal average temperatures in July. They are all located in states that voted for Donald Trump in 2016. And something else you should know about the people moving there, they're disproportionately in their 20s and 30s. Brookings analysis finds that the peak in interstate migration happens in people's late 20s through late 30s. All therefore part of the historically left-leaning millennial generation. You put it all together, and the migratory shift accelerated by the pandemic isn't just a geographical shuffle, it's a political earthquake with young liberals remaking the electoral landscape of the South and West. If these millennials retain their generation's left-leaning politics, they could repaint the red Sun Belt a light shade of blue.
Yep, so that's 100%.
It. Here's the first question that comes from that. I love that. How will these Democrat-leading voters change if the world they operate in changes? So, for example, if you're the Bernie version of the Democratic Party, student loan debt is a much bigger issue if you're in a super expensive, like, hovel in some corner of Brooklyn. Issues around transportation, Amazon factories like of AOC, like, all of those circumstances. Like, if you're your average Jacobin reader, so much of those circumstances are driven by just being in a coastal city. How do you think, let's say, the 30-something couple that moves to Austin from New York, how will they shift? Because from my perspective, and we run into this talk because we have Bernie listeners who think the Democratic Party is conspiring against them. From my perspective, the Democratic Party you're describing seems to be very Mayor Pete-friendly, very Joe Biden-friendly. That is not the party that's going to be pushing for Medicare for All, not because there's a MSNBC fuel conspiracy, but just because the actual bodies in that party is not going to go direct in that way. So how do you think about that?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I don't know for sure, again, because I don't have a great understanding of everyone's motivations for moving. And so I don't know what states are collecting, like, the conservative out migrants from California
Florida.
And what states are collecting Florida, right? Yeah. Actually, I do know, right? I do know the answer to that. but you're right. This, like, you're asking in a way, and correct me if this is a bad paraphrase of your question. Is there a difference for your Democratic Party whose center of gravity is the swoosh between the southwestern states at the four corners, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, and then Georgia, and then including the metros of Texas. Is there a difference between that party and sort of the left leaning party that's emerged in online volume concentrated in Brooklyn and San Francisco.
Yes,
I think there 100%. Might be. Yeah, I think I do think there might be. I mean, look at the senators from the Southwest, right? So this is the first time the Democrats have controlled all 8 senators from the 4 corner Southwest states. That's Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico. First time since the 1930s they've had all 8. But look at the political orientation of those senators. Hickenlooper just won in Colorado. He's not a leftist. He's a classic left-center guy. Kyrsten Sinema, Arizona, probably maybe the most conservative member of the Democratic caucus. Other than
more than Manchin, really?
Other than Manchin, right?
Okay, yeah. I was gonna be shocked.
Probably her and Manchin. Kelly, the new senator, isn't particularly left leaning, and you know, Warnock, you know, Ossoff is clearly was a early resistance darling, but Warnock doesn't strike me as particularly far left. He strikes me as potentially closer. Maybe closer to Hickenlooper in politics than AOC. You might disagree with that.
I think you're right.
Here's what I'd say, because conservative listeners are going to be screaming on cultural issues, especially ones like relate back to the Black community. So his comments about, you know, he had some, I don't want to like quote anything that I don't know for sure, but he basically, there were a couple cringy things he said about the state of the US when he was running for office. So on cultural, but this is the key thing. And this is why like these black voters in the South voted for Joe Biden. On cultural issues, definitely like to the left, but in terms of his economic program, this isn't a Medicare for all guy. But I think that's the key thing that you're saying.
It's a great way of focusing what I was scrambling for, because I'm trying to think of like how his ideology is likely to cash out in Senate votes. And my guess is that when they do like, you know, the GovTrack lineup of like, you know, who are like the most liberal and most conservative senators, that he'll be closer to, you know, Hickenlooper than Bernie.
And this is the key thing, because especially in the Black community, the cultural stands are divorced from the economic ones, and one that I don't think is true in that SF, LA, New York, DC.
That's a really insightful point. That makes a lot of sense to me. So to I guess bring what I'm trying to say to a conclusion, it seems that the Democratic Party of the Southwest and the Southeast is not the party of AOC. It's the party of something else. And they don't necessarily maybe have like a media-friendly ringleader, but like those four corner states will eventually decide like, what is our caucus? What are we for? Like politics in general is becoming way more media-facing, and one's future in politics is about your ability to like broadcast a clear, coherent ideology and brand. Like, what's that Southwest Democratic senator brand going to be? It's not going to be the far left brand. And so I guess the bottom line is my answer to your original question 17,000 minutes ago is yes. These are two different poles within the Democratic Party. And I think there's going to be a little bit of a tug of war sometimes between them.
You know know exactly who. It's Chamath Palihapitiya. if you watch the rhetorical and like ideological stand he's taking here, he says things like inequality, climate change are my number one issues, but he's also like talking about how like, you know, we need to like lower capital gains rates. I would also bet that he would want to end the salt tax, take the salt tax thing back to the pre-2017 era. I think you're going to start seeing a lot more center-left politicians who are probably not political in the traditional sense, who are being very aggressive rhetorically, but like sort of go to that more center-left position. But yeah, Sagar, continue.
My friend who loves Mark Cuban is smiling right now.
No, that's it. No, exactly. No,
he's
no,
like,
no, but
he's
no,
like,
but that's
it's
it.
Mark
that's
Cuban.
It.
Yeah, it's no, as possible. It wouldn't surprise me. No, it's interesting because I'm like, when you're talking, you're like, the future is not AOC. I'm like, yeah, but it's not Chuck Schumer either. You know,
no,
it's gonna be
I totally
some
agree.
Like
right.
It to me, whoever the next Democrat who would think is very likely to replace Doug Ducey is, that is gonna be some flavor within that. And then for a long time, people on the right were like Brian Sandoval, whatever, he was a governor of Nevada, but he was pro-choice, so like that was always a problem. I don't know. I think it's gonna be really interesting, and you're right. It's gonna be this very distinctive flavor of like left politics. I would, it's maybe it's like I wouldn't call it like neoliberal exactly, but it's not as hostile to like, because it's going to have like the Southwestern expansionism to it. It's really interesting.
Well, you know what's interesting about Mark Cuban is, and I'm prepared to get completely virtually slaughtered for this, but what Mark Cuban offers that, say, Mayor Pete doesn't, is the possibility of being a Roosevelt figure, in that Roosevelt was a rich dude screaming at rich dudes.
Yes.
And Chamath, so, once again, there's a theme here.
I remember writing something like this in a piece about Mayor Pete when lefty hate of Mayor Pete was at its max, where I said one reason why he's just such a strange figure is that he identifies up socioeconomically. Mm-hmm. He's just the mayor of South Bend, but he's also representing billionaire interest in the Democratic Party. And historically, successful Democrats have represented down. They've been aristocratic figures like FDR saying, I'm a man of the people. I'm a traitor to my class. But I'm a traitor to my class by identifying down, not by identifying, as Mayor Pete did, up, away from his class status. Mark Cuban has the ability to identify down. He can be a traitor to his own class in a way that might ring as authentic to a lot of moderate left voters who don't believe that every billionaire is a policy and moral error, but do like the idea of someone whose career and television presence is a signifier of competence, but who also loves to go onto television and scream at all the other billionaires for not having earned money like he did. This is not, I'm not paid by Mark Cuban. I actually have no like particular fondness for Mark Cuban. I literally just like don't ever spend any moment of my life thinking about Mark Cuban. I'm like just thinking out loud here. But that would make sense to me, Cuban representing this interest. And then of course, you know, Cuban becoming a kind of Bloomberg figure, but with infinity times Bloomberg's televisual talent, representing a state like Texas in a Democratic primary would make a lot of donors just slobber. Yeah.
100%. What's so funny about this, though, to tie it all together, well, A, discovering that you were paid by Mark Cuban be the lowest level scoop of all time, like the least consequential, least blogged about scoop of all time. But no, but to tie it all together, here's what unites all the different figures we're throwing out there, because I love your trade of the class metaphor. It's tech. Tech as an industry, in terms of the narrative it tells itself about its place in American society, is the only industry from which because think about it, like, why did Howard Schultz not work within this framework? He's like a Starbucks guy. He's very traditional. He identifies with that establishment. Like, that's the point. Like, Michael Bloomberg, Wall Street, identifies with the establishment. If you're a tech person, even if you are as blue as can be as a Democrat, your narrative is still like, I'm a tech person. I'm upending the status quo. I'm going after legacy institutions. This is why, to bring it back to the start of our conversation, our point was there are all of these figures who are operating in the Wall Street Bets conversation who are establishment, who are Harvard educated in the case of the Winklevite twins, but are very comfortable and could somewhat authentically say that they are the enemy and the opposite of that actual power establishment as represented by Wall Street. Another person we could fit into this framework too is Matthew McConaughey, who's doing his like kind of like, I'm right wing, but he's not right wing, but he's actually just a pretty center left Democrat. If he wants to run for governor of Texas, he is operating in this framework too, because he's signaling against Hollywood. So it's just interesting how there are these industries that are producing these sort of figures.
Yeah, it's I think it's plausible. Governor McConaughey is not something that at this moment in time I can possibly conceive of. But you know, then again,
you got to listen
President
to him on
Trump.
Joe Rogan. He wants to run for something.
Okay.
You can tell. He wants to run.
I'll check that out. I think though that the broader thing that you're pointing to, which I'm ambivalent about in terms of it being a good thing, is politics being an increasingly media-facing enterprise. There were a couple news stories that come to mind right now. There was a tweet showing that the amount of tweets by sitting representatives has increased tremendously since the early 2010s. Yes. Another showing that something like half of congressional staffers now are engaged in some form of public relations and communications. Madison Cawthorn at one point said that he was hiring
his
not to make policy.
His entire staff is around Cawthorn.
His entire, he's like, I am a congressman, but I also am like basically a media channel. I don't intend to use this seat to make laws to help people. I thank the public for their votes, and I'm going to make essentially a social media show for them. And if they like the show, they can, you know, re-up it for another season or two. That's basically his explicit promise to his voters. And you're also talking, you know, about two very famous men from TV and film, potentially being the, you know, leaders of the Democratic Party. You know, it leaves something to be desired in terms of expertise.
Public policy outcomes.
Yeah, and public policy. And I don't want to suggest that, like, I think Mark Cuban's a really smart guy. I don't think that, like, this isn't about Mark Cuban. Again, I'm being paid by Mark Cuban, so I can't criticize him for too long here. But it's not that I don't think that someone who was a co-host in Shark Tank can, like, make good tax policy. I just think that if, as a general principle, if we use, as a kind of funneling mechanism, media fame as the most important mechanism for deciding who to lead the country, like, that's going to be really fucked for a long period of time in ways that are a lot broader than just Trump, period. It's a little concerning just that the only people we can consider to lead us as a people are televisual celebrities.
I 100% agree with you, Derek. And this is where all of us being in DC, like, it matters. Whereas I'm like, yeah, Trump came in and he said he was going to do X, but he didn't know how to run or who to appoint for, like, his deputy secretary of commerce in order to make sure that was going to happen. Or, you know, Mark Cuban, yeah, he wants a big industrial policy. Okay, I hope you know 1,000 people who are ready to implement that on a bureaucratic wide level, and that you know exactly how to weed through, like, who worked for whom and all that. And it's a problem. I see it with congressional staff. Most of these congressional staff are just trying to get retweeted by Comfortably Smug on Twitter on the right, and on the left, they want, like, Matt Iglesias and probably you to retweet them. They don't care about policy. They don't care about any of this stuff. It's the Iglesias ones probably care more than the Comfortably Smug ones. Let's be honest. But
Don't both sides this one.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to both sides this one. I will be honest, even though many of these people consider my friends, and many of them listen to this podcast, so I'm sorry. But if you think about what that portends for policy, it's a bad thing. Because the point I've tried to make consistently to people is that when you come in as an outsider and you just focus all on the comms, is that the machine, so to speak, just runs along uninterrupted. As in, like, you can't change policy because it's basically everything is on a stasis path. I remember probably the most insightful thing Obama ever said is, he's like, you think when you're president that you can come in, you're taking this ship, and that you can, like, turn it one way or turn it the other way. And he's like, and the truth is, like, if you're successful, you can turn it 2 degrees west or 2 degrees east. And yeah, in the long run, that's going to end up, like, really, really far away. But he's like, even as president, the best I can probably do is 2 degrees. There's criticisms of that from progressive left and right, which I would agree with. But I think the best you can probably do, even in a crisis like Biden, maybe like 5 degrees. 5 degrees is a lot, like we said, and that's going to change what the dynamic is. But this is where media, I think, and thinking about how that evolves matters even more, because if this is the industry which is going to bear out our future political leaders. And I know it's something that you've looked at a lot too.
Well,
and
can I say,
the point that you made
about Comfortably Smug and Matt Iglesias.
Yes.
I'm not going to, obviously, I think Matt's brilliant. I think Comfortably Smug is whatever. But, like, look, what's interesting about that from a media theory standpoint is that what you're saying is these electeds, handlers, and policy advisors are really just trying to impress someone else in media who will amplify their status.
Bingo.
Which means that they're really just outsourcing their policy ideology to Matt Iglesias.
Yes.
In which case, the danger that I didn't even put together but makes a lot of sense is that if the Mark Cubans of the world get power, and or just in general, politics becomes more and more media-facing, the people we elect are outsourcing their policy to people who are outsourcing their policy to Twitter celebrities.
That's so
which
true.
Means that in a weird way, it's actually government by Twitter celebrity. It's just who's your proximate Twitter celebrity, right? And so the danger there is like you're not actually making any determination of like you're not electing people to make decisions. You're electing people with the hope that they surround themselves with advisors who follow the right people on Twitter. Like that's a little bit of a weird proposition for American democracy.
And you know what's crazy? This reminds me, one of our favorite episodes was Jane Costin right before the election. And she was like, the Trump campaign is way too fucking online. It was like, you know, you'd see like all these dudes tweeting about like Ibrahim. By the way, like a lot of criticisms of Ibrahim Kendi. We can go listen to our podcast about that and critical race theory and all that. But then they put out like the 1619 Project executive order. And you're like, who is voting for this shit? Like, pass some $1,200 checks. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Or like, they would be like, we will not allow. They take like some viral tweet and blow it up, like, we will not allow this to happen. Or even Trump literally measuring his campaign. Like, in many of the ways, and I experienced it because a lot of these people I used to talk, was that a lot of the people in the Trump campaign would measure how they were doing relative to the criticism that they were getting online. And then they would beg us to cover it here. They'd beg me to cover it, you know, over on the show. Like, please, can you praise this one policy? Or like, can you write the blah? Some of it was PR, but it's exactly the dynamic that you're talking about. And, you know, I actually think it's interesting because, and look, I think Matt is, you know, pretty smart. And I'm glad we've had him on the podcast. He actually even talked about this recently where he was like, you can see that our Twitter discourse around deficits has actually measurably changed the Biden economic policy. That's a good thing. I'm 100% for that. But you're like, like in a conceptual level, like outsourcing it all there isn't necessarily a good
right.
thing.
I think it's right. You want to be, go ahead.
And just
go
quick ahead, thing Mark. On this, because it speaks to, I have to do every episode, I have to like defend Joe Biden for no particularly good reason. It speaks to Joe Biden's strength as a politician right now in this moment, which is that he just either doesn't know or he doesn't, I think actually doesn't care. I think he genuinely does not care about this reality. And I think it's one of those issues where this isn't going to be an issue which is naturally going to resolve itself because Joe Biden, it's an area where this is the advantage of being in politics for 40 years. He just does not care in a way that politicians that are going to come after him are going to just have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Joe Biden, from a media standpoint, Joe Biden was like the politician of local news. You know, he just, he kept things super so normal and kind of dry and like not, and won that way. I totally agree. I think that in a weird way, the 2020 election was the election that the internet lost. Joe Biden was the internet's least favorite candidate for months. For months.
Yeah.
Everyone I followed, and I follow a pretty wide variety of people from the politics world, were doing nothing but dumping on Joe Biden. And Biden didn't care. And then Trump, I totally agree with Jane on this point, got way too deep into his own Twitter world and essentially started legislating or not legislating, essentially started just being oriented.
Like Russiagate. Russiagate was only a thing on right-wing Twitter. Nobody gives a shit about Russiagate or whoever the FBI agent is or whatever. And they're like, oh, we got to declassify him. Like, that's the MAGA priority? Like,
yeah.
Declassification?
I think it speaks to the fact that a challenge that, and this goes, I guess, to the point I was making earlier about sort of outsourcing electeds, outsourcing their policy priorities to their favorite Twitter celebrity. It's really difficult, and maybe this is true in politics and just in general life, to be the right amount of online. If you go offline, I find this in my own job specifically. If I'm not on Twitter for 2 weeks, and I'm like, oh, I have a good idea for like an article to write, it turns out I'm like 72 hours behind the news cycle, and the article has no lift. But if I do nothing but stay on Twitter, then I don't write at all, and I get really, really sucked into like the deepest, deepest silo of some debate. It's really, really hard as a writer, I think, to be just online enough. And that like internet Goldilocks problem is something that Biden just clearly solved. That campaign was just online enough to be sensitive to people's concerns without following them into any particular area where they would be, you know, shown to be out of touch with the average American.
Absolutely.
So for our last bit here, I love that we're talking about media theory because, funnily enough, I first came across your work because I loved your 2017, 2018, like, what's the state of, like, media crises right now? You did a post, like, both Christmases and everything. But another piece you wrote recently is just about the fracturing of America post 1950, which is basically summed up by America as a whole is becoming nicher and nicher. So everything is about like your niche, which is also the story of media today, and how in many ways, I think the best line, my favorite line, was just the point that it used to be enough to have MSNBC, CNN, and then Fox, and now we now have OANN, and then we also have Newsmax. So it's not even enough to like break up the former Walter Cronkite space. It needs to be broken even more up. It gets harder and harder to operate in these smaller spaces. And I'm not sure if you're on Clubhouse or anything, but last night, you know, Elon Musk went on Clubhouse. And Jessica Lessen at The Information, who's Sagar and I are huge fan of, was like talking about how because Mark Andreessen, who is in the chat as well too, blocked certain journalists from getting access, journalists couldn't actually get access to the conversation. At the same point though, like Elon Musk doesn't really care about the fact that you're kicking out gatekeepers because he's appealing to this very niche audience of people who are the Elon Musk, like trading card sellers who are basically engaging their own version of meme stalking. So I think the broader framework that would be helpful for people is how should anyone who looks at the current state of our politics and dissatisfied think about how you work, even attempt to put things back together when everything basically comes down to how can you best own and operate within a niche? Both at a business model level, but also from a performance level?
I think it's a great question. My thesis is that you just have to operate as if everything is a cult and get kind of comfortable with it. Culting, I think, is what successful companies do by turning customers like Apple customers into rabid fans of what's essentially just, you know, glass and metal and software. But it's also clearly what message boards have to do as well. GameStop is a cult and QAnon is a cult. And to a certain extent, you know, there were aspects of Bernie world that were cultish too. I'm a huge fan of a lot of Bernie does. I'm ambivalent about whether or not like cults are always good or bad. I think that cults are like a mechanism. It's a cult as I'm defining it in this circumstance. Is a tightly bound group that is defined both positively and negatively. Negatively by a shared insistence that something about the mainstream is wrong, and positively by a similar confidence that they have the right answer. And what you have, I think, in the media landscape is a kind of fragmentation that is perfect for the propagation of many, 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 many cults. And this really just goes back to media technology. In the early 19th century, the technology that was available to people in the early 1800s was steam-powered printing presses before the telegraph, which means you had thousands of local papers that had no idea what was going on anywhere else. So all you had was a million local realities. And then in the early 20th century, you had radio and television, which were tightly regulated markets with international communication, such that you finally had the opportunity to have a sort of global shared reality, right? Especially in the 1950s when there's only a handful of channels in television. And now with the internet, we're sort of back to the 19th century where media technology is totally decentralized, totally decentralizing, such that we're going back to a world with many, many, many different shared realities. And I think—
How do you govern that?
Mostly—
Well, yeah, that's the real question.
Yeah, you don't, to a certain extent. It is almost until something else comes along that is naturally centralizing, reality is ungovernable, especially with the First Amendment. It just shouldn't be illegal for a bunch of people to be misled about stuff. It's just an inevitable part of the sort of riotous market of ideas that's just what's going to happen. You're going to have lots of people who have their own little cultish fantasies. And the way that you, so it's not governable in the biggest sense, but the way you try to govern is what I suggested Joe Biden do in my piece 2 weeks ago. You go big, you go fast, and you go simple. Big, fast, and simple means you have a handful of priorities that you communicate extremely clearly. You focus on them and you make sure that those achievements are felt in people's lives. That they're so obvious that they cut through the cultifying sort of film of media.
Yeah.
That it doesn't matter what Fox News or OAN tells you about your bank account. If it increases by 1,400 and Biden goes on television and is like, hey, that was me. I did the 1,400. There it is. That's 1,400. If there is a universal child allowance that gives you $300 a month for your two kids and you get that into your checking account every single month, it doesn't matter what anyone on Fox News tells you. The money is yours. And Joe Biden, again, can go on TV and be like, hey, everyone, mm-hmm. you see all that money that's in your bank account? Yep, that's me too. You do things that people feel. I don't know any other possible way you can combat this, because I don't think you can combat it at like the epistemic level, at the media level. The Pandora's box is open and the monster's fucking everywhere. You have to combat it at the level of big, fast, and simple policy.
So for our last two questions, Ben, you said so much there. It's like really great. We'll have to do another episode at some point. But here's my question, though. You made the point that you basically argued you can't just govern these things. You can't make these choices. But here's the problem, especially if you're at a tech company, you actually can't. Reddit like killed the QAnon forum years ago. Twitter killed QAnon and it's gone, right? Like I have family members who are into Q stuff. Like they've moved on. So I'm not saying on a philosophical level that means they'd made the right decision in some degrees, which is because there are cults that I would find like deeply off-putting and even dangerous that I wouldn't support like censoring or banning, but you actually can govern them, right? So like, you kind of get what I'm saying. What I'm saying is like, we could say that you can't, but like, it seems to me there's a lot of evidence that you can.
Yeah, I want to be clear in saying that I initially took your question, this might not have been its intent, as saying, what does an executive or legislative branch do about the fact that the internet allows a bunch of different people to create a bunch of different Facebook and Gab and Parler and Twitter groups that often participate in the construction of a reality that is fictional? And my answer is, I don't know. I have no idea. Yeah. I have no idea. I'm not saying nothing should be done. I'm saying the project of deciding what kinds of misunderstandings or fictions about the world are all right and which ones are illegal, it's a fucking mess. And I have no idea what that looks like. I'm not saying no law should be made. I'm saying I literally just don't know how you handle it.
Well, what I love about that is, so we actually do largely agree. Because like you were answering this in the context of the state. What's interesting is that from my perspective, and then Sagar will go to you for your last one, which is that tech companies are being asked to govern in a way and make those decisions. That's where a lot of the controversy comes from. And then the tech companies themselves, for a variety of reasons that I actually largely support, are outside of the realm of like state or government action. So like that's where you see a lot of those governing decisions lead to controversy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, clearly Facebook and Twitter have been put in the position of acting like quasi-political institutions because there's no political law to guide the decision-making. I get that point. But I don't know, maybe you should go in and offer your two cents, because I just don't know. I don't have like the white paper on hand to be like, this is how to fix the situation going forward. Like, I agree with you. QAnon is horrible, and it's probably a better world where QAnon specifically as like cannot share information about like, you know, elite Jews like drinking the blood of children. Like, it's a better world where as few as people as mm-hmm. possible are talking about Jews drinking blood. But I don't know how you write legislation that is broadly applicable, that bans that kind of talk, unless you ban something that isn't talk, right? Yes, you ban like the some connection between language, communication, and incitement. But I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly how to frame that.
100%. You know, it's just funny because while you're talking, I'm not saying it's a fatalist position, but it's more just like, this is how it's going to be. And you made a really interesting point there about the steamboat, like pre-steamboat, and when we had 1,000 different papers. If you think about what like life for the average American in the 1840s was, like the federal government like wasn't really a thing. Mm-hmm. Like in terms of like how you thought about it, you're like, yeah, like, you know, we're in the United States. Like we vote in a presidential election and we do actually they didn't even have income tax then. So like, it's like mm-hmm. we pay our booze tax to mm-hmm. Andrew Jackson and that's about it. But like it mostly was inconsequential. And a lot of those decisions were made like within the communities themselves, not really from somebody at the top down. It's very possible that I'm not saying, you know, we're going to have like cults that govern themselves the way that some towns did and stuff, but it might be analogous to that. And it's downstream of the media environment that we're living in. And I think that that's just really fascinating to think, what does that look like in a 21st century environment?
Yeah. I encourage people to read What Hath God Wrought, which is a history of America between the, just after the
maybe
1815 to 1848.
Oh, this is the Oxford history.
I have not read any of them, but I know which ones I need to talk about.
That's so I read funny. Freedom from Fear. I didn't read the other ones. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. What if God Wrought? It was recommended to me by Jordan Weissman at Slate, who's fantastic. And I am obsessed with the 19th century and in particular with sort of the fount of inventiveness in the 19th century, like the fact that literally everything was invented in like a 30-year span between 1880 and 1910, except for the telegraph and the train. And the telegraph and the train just like completely smashed the ancient world. Like mm-hmm. the world that was shrunk by the telegraph and the train was just so different than the one that came before it. And it's interesting to think that we might ironically just be going back to that like pre-telegraph train world where local realities were permitted to flourish because there was no ability for people to communicate across distances. Now it's because people don't want to communicate across distances. They recognize they'd much prefer to have their confirmation bias lapped up by their local media, whatever it is.
There you go. All right, Derek, really appreciate this conversation, man. Where can people check all your work out? Derek Thompson, I think is Derek Thompson on Twitter?
DK Thomp on Twitter, DK Thomp and at The Atlantic. And that'd be good.
Cool, man. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the episode. We really appreciate it. As always, subscribe to therealignment.substack.com so you can interact with us, ask questions, get the transcripts, all of that. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Let's look at our bookshop. What am I missing, Marshall? Anything?
A huge thank you to the Lincoln Network for continuing to support our awesome work here. We will see you on Thursday. We have a really cool episode coming up that you guys are really going to kick out of.